I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. President Trump is not the only person who wants the country to get back to work. Millions of Americans have lost their jobs because of the pandemic shutdown. The race is on to develop tests for coronavirus because without that information, we don't know who is a carrier and contagious. And equally as important, the race is on to develop a safe and effective vaccine that Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's leading infectious disease expert, says could be 12 to 18 months away. Here he is explaining to Fox's Laura Ingraham last night about why a vaccine is so critical to fighting this new virus and how this new virus is different from SARS and HIV.
HIV/AIDS is entirely different. We don't have a vaccine for HIV/AIDS, but we have spectacularly effective treatment. People who invariably would have died years ago, right now, are leading essentially normal lives. SARS is a different story. SARS disappeared. We developed a vaccine. We were in the process of going through the various phases. We showed it was safe. We showed it induced a good response. And then SARS disappeared. And we didn't need to develop a vaccine for SARS. So I think it's a little bit misleading maybe to compare what we're going through now with HIV or SARS. They're really different.
This hour on Radio Times, we're going to look at what we know about this deadly pathogen, how it infects the body, and what it will take to fight back. And joining us is Paul Offit. He's director of the Vaccine Education Center, professor of pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine recommended for universal use for infants by the CDC. He's also got a new book called Overkill, When Modern Medicines Go Too Far. And Paul Offit, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. Also with us is Angela Rasmussen, and she's a virologist at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, and she studies host responses to infection. And Angela Rasmussen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me here, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, any questions, this is the place to call, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and leave a comment on our Facebook page, and we will get your questions on the air. Angela, if I could begin with you, and it's interesting to compare this to SARS and HIV and MERS and other viruses that have threatened human populations. Why has this particular virus essentially brought the world to its knees?
So there's one really key difference between this virus and SARS classic or MERS coronavirus, and that is that it's much more transmissible. Original SARS was effectively contained, taking these quarantine and lockdown measures, and it has not reemerged from its natural reservoir for reasons that we don't completely understand. MERS coronavirus, as it turns out, can be more lethal. It has a higher case fatality rate, but it's much more difficult to transmit from person to person. SARS coronavirus 2 transmits very efficiently from one person to the next, and it can also be transmitted prior to a person knowing that they're sick when they're pre-symptomatic. So that has made it very, very difficult to contain with these sort of classic epidemiological measures, contact tracing and so forth, that we're used to hearing about.
Paul, we call it new or a novel coronavirus. I mean, essentially, the world does not have an immune system at this point to fight back.
That's right. There's no pre-existing immunity. So therefore, this virus has the capacity to do what it's doing, which is to sweep across the world, causing a worldwide epidemic or pandemic that has, as you said, brought us to our knees.
One description I read, and I'll put this to you, that it's easy to catch but hard to kill, at least at this point, correct?
Yeah, certainly easy to catch, I think, and probably more easy to catch than flu. I think we're going to sort of learn about that as we look back on this. In terms of hard to kill, I think, there are a number of antivirals that are currently in the works. I think the one that was promoted early on, the so-called hydroxychloroquine, at least the three early studies, at least reasonably controlled studies, have shown that it doesn't appear to work and also has side effects that involve toxicities to the heart. I think the more promising drugs are drugs like remdesivir, which is an antiviral drug which works by making it difficult for the virus to reproduce itself. There's other products out there like flavipiravir or lopinavir. So those are all in the midst of being tested by NIH-funded prospective placebo-controlled trials. And we'll see. I think I have a lot more hope for drugs like remdesivir than hydroxychloroquine.
I want to get back to that. But Angela, let me turn to you and help us understand then how this virus, and it has kind of spiky hooks, what happens when it enters the human body? It comes in what? Through the nose, essentially, or the mouth?
Yeah, so it comes in the nose or the mouth and goes into the respiratory tract. And those spiky hooks that you mentioned is a protein on the surface of the virus particle called spike. It's a great name as far as viral proteins go. Spike connects with a protein on the surface of cells in your respiratory tract called ACE2. When it does that, it is taken up inside the cell in a little compartment, and then it escapes that compartment and begins to replicate. So it copies its genome, it makes viral proteins, and it assembles new virus particles that then leave the cell and go on to infect other cells. What we don't know right now is which part of that causes actual COVID disease. We've seen that there's quite a large range of disease presentations with this virus. It's possible, and in fact likely, that some of the most severe disease actually occurs when the body has sort of exaggerated reaction to the virus infection itself. So rather than clearing the virus, the immune system essentially overreacts and causes damage itself.
And this is this, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, is it cytokine or cytokine storm?
The cytokine storm, that's correct. So cytokines are essentially messages that your cells send to each other. And in this case, the cytokines in question are essentially telling the inflammatory system, hey, we have a virus infection here, let's get rid of it. The problem is that when those messages are sent out indiscriminately in a storm, if you will, the body reacts by going into a sort of overdrive inflammatory state. And that in itself can cause damage.
And is that when we hear about people being put on ventilators? I mean, is this a sign that they're in serious distress?
I might punt this question to Dr. Offit, since I'm not a physician. It's very interesting the reason why patients are going on ventilators. Typically, ventilators are used for people who are having problems breathing mechanically. Their lungs are not working properly. There are some indications that patients with severe COVID who need to be on ventilators actually don't have enough oxygen in their blood. And so some people have said that ventilators may not actually be the best approach. But again, I defer to a physician on this one.
Absolutely. Paul, you want to take that?
Sure. So I think we're learning as we go here. Dr. Rasmussen said, I think first of all, the virus can itself infect or damage the lungs, you know, the lining of the cells that line the lungs, so causing direct sort of viral cytotoxicity, if you will. Or it can cause this sort of so-called cytokine storm, which, you know, for which at least there are some medicines that sort of can counteract that. I think we're just learning about exactly what the story is in terms of how exactly how this virus does damage the lungs and whether or not ventilation really is the best way to go. And I think it 2 years from now, when we look back at this, we'll have a much better idea of exactly what's happening.
Well, let me ask you now, though, Paul Offit, I'll go back to you. And what I guess what's so confounding and perhaps worrisome is that for some people who have contracted this disease, they have no symptoms. They're asymptomatic. Some people have mild symptoms and they recover at home. And obviously, some people have very severe symptoms. How important is it to understand that those sort of varieties of responses to this particular virus?
Yeah, I think that's what makes this so heinous, as Dr. Rasmussen referred to earlier. I mean, if for SARS or MERS, you knew who was sick. Those viruses made you sick. And so it was easy to sort of put a moat around them and therefore in some ways stop them. I think smallpox, for example, there's no such thing as asymptomatic smallpox. Everyone who has smallpox is sick, and everyone who has smallpox will have, you know, blisters on their face. So you know who's sick. And so in many ways, it was easier to sort of try and stop or at least put a moat around those infections. That's not true here. I mean, and I think that's what causes such panic in the community. You don't really know who's shedding virus. You don't really know who it is that you're coming in contact with who could infect you. And this data came out of China very early on, that 80% of people who are infected with this virus may have no symptoms or very mild symptoms. And I think that's the fear. In many ways, it's sort of reminiscent of AIDS. I mean, when AIDS first hit in the early 1980s, nobody really knew what caused it or how to catch it. And so people were just scared to touch a piece of fruit in the grocery store. This sort of has that feeling now.
Well, and to you, Angela Rasmussen, I mean, that explains why we're hunkering at home, why we're wearing face masks if we are out in public, because there's so much we don't understand about this virus.
That's correct. So we have been, I think, very hindered by the fact that we didn't appreciate early on that this virus can be transmitted by people who may not even know that they're sick. And now it's quite clear that that can occur. So we just, the only thing we can really do without testing widely and understanding the prevalence and being able to catch some of these cases before the patients become symptomatic and before they've had a chance to transmit, if we don't have the testing capacity to do that, then the only real option for us is to engage in these sort of broad, very restrictive social distancing measures.
And Paul, I would think once we get some tests, you want tests that have a test for whoever, I mean, maybe everybody, but you want tests that have quick results, correct?
Yes, and we can do that. I think, I mean, if you look at what Germany's doing, Germany has done a much better job at this than we have. They have tests in hand. They're now, you know, using those tests to sort of assign who can comfortably go back to work and who not. And, you know, they've flattened the curve and are going back. We have largely flattened the curve. And I think the degree to which we can start crawling out of our homes and going back to work, at least slowly, kind of testing the water with one foot at a time, is going to depend on, as Dr. Rasmussen says, extensive testing. And there's no reason that scientifically we can't do what Germany is doing, which is get those tests out there and help us get back to work.
But if we're not doing that, why not, Paul? What's the problem?
I just think it's one of the many things that we're failing at here. We just don't have a very good coordinated sort of national effort to get tests out there. There's no reason that couldn't be done, certainly scientifically and just in terms of our economics. We should be able to do that. We just haven't done it.
What are your thoughts, Angela?
I completely agree with Dr. Offit. I'm completely baffled as to why the testing capacity has been so slow to ramp up. It's certainly not because of any scientific hindrances or technical hindrances to rolling out these tests. The two types of tests in question are a PCR test, which looks directly for the virus, and an antibody test or serology test that looks for antibodies to the virus. That indicates that you might have had the infection before. Both of those testing technologies are widespread throughout clinical diagnostic laboratories around the country. It's incredibly unclear to me why that testing capacity hasn't ramped up to the levels that we need it at.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break, and let me just quickly reintroduce our guest. That's Dr. Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. She studies host responses to infection. We are talking about COVID-19, the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus that has put the world on its heels. Dr. Paul Offit with us as well, director of the Vaccine Education Center, professor of pediatrics at the Division of Infectious Diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And we have rheumatologist Belinda Birnbaum waiting in the wings. She is recovering from a month-long battle with COVID-19. And we want to hear from you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Drs. Paul Offit and Angela Rasmussen about the quest to find a vaccine for coronavirus, the battle against COVID-19. And joining us now is rheumatologist Belinda Birnbaum, who is one of the lucky ones to have survived COVID-19. She first felt sick back this winter and over the course of a number of weeks became desperately ill. She was twice taken to the hospital for treatment and released. Her husband and one of her two kids contracted the virus, have since recovered. And we asked her to join us on Radio Times to tell us what this experience was like for her. And Belinda Birnbaum, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, how are you feeling?
Well, it's been a slow recovery. You know, a lot of times when you get sick from your typical upper respiratory infection, you feel sick, you bounce back in a few days, and this has been more of a slow climb.
Well, in fact, it began back in February, correct?
Well, I have ongoing seasonal allergies and someone that gets a cough for a few weeks after every time I get a viral illness. So I had been coughing since the middle of February, which is nothing unusual for me. And what happened was, everyone was getting concerned, this anticipatory anxiety about coronavirus. The week of March 9th, had been rounding in my hospital, seeing patients. We weren't doing widespread testing on hospitalized patients at the time. We were still seeing patients in the office with upper respiratory symptoms. Mm. And that weekend, I started to feel not just my usual cough, but developed a fever and lost my sense of smell.
Wow. Wow. And that is apparently one of the symptoms of COVID-19.
Yes, and so it happened to both me and my husband. And fortunately, my health system, Mainline Health, had set up drive-through testing. And because I was a healthcare worker, was able to get tested through the Department of Health and get my results back 24 hours later, which confirmed that I was positive.
What was your response to that? I mean, you're a physician, but what was your response to learning of this diagnosis?
You know, it was kind of expected. You kind of see it coming, and it was kind of a slow wave of dread that came over. But at the time, I wasn't feeling that terrible. I felt just kind of like you would any time you had a flu with a low-grade fever. I was able to drive myself to and from the testing site. The following day, as I got my results, I was actually working from home, talking with patients and coughing, but wasn't feeling terrible. But by the next day, I was really not feeling well.
In fact, you went to the you wrote about this in the Philadelphia Inquirer, but you went to the hospital twice, correct?
Sure. Yeah. About 10 days into being sick, there was an incredible amount of anorexia or loss of appetite that came with this. And so dehydration because of the loss of appetite and the pretty constant fever. And about 10 days in, I started having vomiting as well and was completely dehydrated. And so that was, in addition to having the cough and the shortness of breath, that's really what brought me into the hospital the first time into the emergency room.
I mean, and I would think shortness of breath is anxiety producing. You can't get enough air into your lungs.
There's an air hunger, and it's uncomfortable. And what's even more uncomfortable is the uncertainty that comes along with this, mm-hmm. because you just don't know if you're someone who's going to be sick at home for a few days and then feel better, or if you're going to take a turn for the worse. I'm fortunate enough to have friends who are emergency room physicians and critical care physicians who were able to advise me from home and say, unless you're really having trouble breathing, don't come into the emergency room. And I kind of heeded their advice. And when I got dehydrated and they said, now come in, that's when I went into the emergency room.
Part of the article is you and your husband really talked about, and I don't mean to be overly dramatic here, but just if something happened to one of you and what would happen to your children, it really got to that point.
There was one morning, it was about 5 or 6 days in, because he also tested positive and he's also a physician. And he did not have symptoms that were similar to mine. He lost his sense of smell. He had a headache. He never had a fever. He had a severe cough. And he woke up and I woke up and we both were feeling pretty terrible. And we said, what if we both need to go to the hospital? What happens to our kids? It's not like, oh, I'm sick, can you check in on my kids? Nobody wants to come into our house. And God forbid, what if we took a turn for the worse? What would we do? And it got us really starting to think about our advanced directives and making sure that things were in place if God forbid, things went there, which thankfully they didn't.
Yeah. One of your children contracted the virus and one did not.
One did not, yeah. So my 12-year-old son, about 6 or 7 days in, sitting there on screen time, as are most of our kids, and we started to hear this horrible cough and had a friend drop off a thermometer. We didn't want to use the same one for him that we were using, and sure enough, he had a fever. And he felt sick for a few days and then was okay. And my 10-year-old daughter has been perfectly fine this entire time with no symptoms.
Let me get our other two guests back in on the conversation, Dr. Paul Offit and Dr. Angela Rasmussen. Dr. Rasmussen, anything you want to add or ask our guest?
I think it's very interesting. Maybe that's not the right word, but I think it's the spread of symptoms in the family. And it sounds as though your older child had symptoms, whereas your younger child either was not infected or did not have symptoms. And that's somewhat consistent with some of the data that's being reported anyways, that younger children are less at risk. I'd also be very curious to hear Dr. Offit's thoughts on this, given that he is a pediatrician.
Right, exactly.
But I think that it's very interesting.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Offit.
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? It certainly, I mean, if you look, for example, of the, 32,000 or so people who have died in the United States of this virus, fewer than five are children, meaning children, anyone less than 18 years of age. That's not true of flu. I mean, flu has, killed actually similar numbers, probably around 35,000 to 40,000 people, but more than 150 children have died of flu. So I'm not sure this virus seems to uniquely spare young children. It also seems to attack primarily those over 65 who have comorbidities. I mean, when we had the 2009-2010 flu pandemic strain, circulating in the United States then, of the 12,000 deaths, only 20% were in those over 65. That virus infected primarily younger, healthier people. So why there's a difference, I don't know.
Well, Belinda, before we say goodbye to you, anything you want to say to our listeners? And I know people are antsy. They want to get out of their house. They're sick of walking around with, with masks and gloves and all of that. What do you have any advice for our listeners as we try to make it through this pandemic?
I have two things that I'll offer. One is, I think that my household is a case study for why we're practicing the social distancing that we are practicing. My daughter could very easily have been a carrier and gone to school and given that to her classmates or teacher. And so that to me is a argument for why we continue to stay home. And then being in the hospital as a patient during this pandemic, knowing that people aren't allowed to have visitors or bring things with them, I would suggest to everyone, in addition to getting advance directives in order, that if you do think you need to go to the emergency room, that you be prepared, that you bring your phone, that you bring your charger, that you bring a list of your medications and your allergies, that you bring a list of contacts for people to call that include people in your household and out of your household, and that you bring things to make yourself comfortable if you have to be there, because the nurses and physicians are working so hard that, bringing you a blanket is not their priority right now. And so if you're feeling that sick and you do have to go, think about what you want to take with you.
That's such great advice, and I'm glad you're feeling better, and I do
Thank
appreciate
you so much.
You're welcome. I do appreciate you joining us on Radio Time. Such an important story to tell. That's Belinda Birnbaum. She's a rheumatologist. She sees patients at Bryn Mawr Hospital, which is just outside of Philadelphia, and she is recovering from a month-long battle with COVID-19. Dr. Angela Rasmussen and Dr. Paul Offit staying with us for the rest of the hour. We are talking about testing for COVID-19, we will be getting in greater detail about how to develop a vaccine, and of course, taking your questions and comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Here's an email from Richard. He says, if COVID-19 is a strain of the coronavirus, which includes the common cold that humans have lived with for thousands of years, shouldn't our immune system have a leg up on fighting it? Can I toss that to you, Dr. Offit?
Sure. Right. There are basically four human coronaviruses that have circulated in this world for a while. I mean, they were first identified in the early 1960s. But every year, about 15% to 20% of the respiratory infections that come into Children's Hospital of Philadelphia are caused by one or another of those human coronaviruses. But they are antigenically distinct immunologically from this coronavirus. So having previous experience with those human coronaviruses apparently offers nothing for the stop of the spread of this virus.
Do you want to answer that, Dr. Rasmussen?
Yeah, so those four common cold coronaviruses, some of them are actually in a different part of the coronavirus family than this particular coronavirus. SARS coronavirus 2 SARS coronavirus and MERS coronavirus are all beta coronaviruses, which is essentially the part of the coronavirus family that they're in. Some of those common cold coronaviruses are alpha coronaviruses, which is essentially a different family. So they're like cousins. Your immune system can't tell the difference or can tell the difference between those two different families. So as Dr. Offit said, they are antigenically distinct, meaning that your immune system is going to recognize them as different viruses.
Oh, fascinating. I mean, it's just fascinating. We're learning how our body works fending off this virus. Dr. Offit, let me go back to you. And Dr. Rasmussen mentioned this right before the break, which is when it comes to testing, you're looking for the virus or you're looking for an immune response to the virus. Help us understand, I guess, the difference between those and what they could reveal to us.
Right. So the testing actually, when they do that so-called nasopharyngeal swab, looking for virus, what they're looking for actually are sort of genetic fragments of the virus. So it's not the actual live virus itself. It's the sort of genetic fragment. So that doesn't necessarily tell you that you're shedding live virus, although I think it's a good marker for it. I mean, in the world of rotavirus, which was an intestinal virus that I worked on for about a quarter of a century, I mean, you would shed infectious virus for about 5 or 6 days, but you could be PCR positive, meaning you would shed small fragments of the genome for as long as 6 months. So it's not a perfect test, but it's a decent surrogate for the fact that you probably are still infected. The serological test, and I'm looking forward to getting that test out there. I think that, you know, you make sort of two different kinds of antibodies when you're infected with the virus. The first is called immunoglobulin M, which is kind of made early after the infection. Then coming up a little later is immunoglobulin G. I think that if you have people who've been exposed to this virus who now are making immunoglobulin G but not immunoglobulin M, I think you can say this person is likely to be immune to this virus. And the early challenge studies with human coronaviruses done years ago showed that if you're infected, and these were experimental human challenge studies, if you're infected with one type of human coronavirus, you would be protected against that for at least a year. And I think the answer is probably for at least years, but likely not decades. So I think that's all promising for the making of a vaccine. But I think it would be great to get serological testing out there that's reliable, that's specific. So you can say, look, this person is likely to be immune. This person can go back to work. This person can go visit people in a nursing home. This people can help people who shop who can't shop. I mean, all the things that you'd like to have this army of immune people out there doing.
Well, and Dr. Rasmussen, that just underscores why testing is so important, because then if we know who has tested or what the antibody test is revealing, we can figure out who might be able to go back to work, who might be able to go back to school.
That's correct. So I think it's absolutely critical for a couple reasons to roll out widespread serology testing. One reason is that we actually don't know many of the cases that occurred. So for just epidemiology reasons, we need to know how prevalent this virus actually is, how many people were actually exposed to it. And because the PCR tests that Dr. Offit mentioned have not been as widely available, there are probably a lot of people who had COVID, didn't know that they had COVID, that we need to identify. And second, as Dr. Offit also said, we need to identify those people with IgG antibodies that are likely to be neutralizing. And it's important to note that all of the data so far does suggest that IgG antibodies are associated with neutralization, meaning that they can bind the virus and render it non-infectious, which is really important for protective immunity. There are a number of patients, a very small subset of patients, that don't appear to have IgG levels despite having confirmed positive cases of coronavirus. So we can't 100% make the assumption that IgG antibodies are the only indicator of protective immunity. But fortunately, it does look as though most patients do develop these antibodies and are likely to be protected against reinfection.
Dr. Offit, here's an email from Joe. Thinking about all the asymptomatic people, has there been any work on developing, quote, disclosing agents analogous to the red dye used to reveal areas missed in toothbrushing that would make it easier to detect that a person is currently infected with COVID-19?
So I'm not sure I understand the question exactly, but I think that's what makes this so hard, is that there's so many asymptomatic shedders. But I think as Dr. Rasmussen said, if we could have gotten widespread PCR testing out there, we could have done so much better of a job at as other countries have done. And South Korea had done almost 200,000 PCR tests before we'd done 500, and that enabled them to get on top of this epidemic as Japan did, as Singapore did, as ultimately China did, because they were much better at testing than we were. There was no excuse for the delays in PCR testing that we had here.
Dr. Evan, assuming even if we get more tests, they will be limited tests. Who are the people who should be tested?
You ask me or Dr. Rasmussen?
Dr. Offit, go ahead and answer you, Dr. Rasmussen. We're all home and we're disconnected. You can't see each other, but go ahead, Dr. Offit.
So who to test first? So I think you want to make sure that you want to test people who are frontline responders. I mean, because you know they're the ones who are most likely to come in contact with this. You want to make sure that you test people who work around people who are older, especially you look at all the disproportionate number of deaths that have occurred in nursing homes. So I think those would be the groups I think that you would initially want to take a look at.
How about for you, Dr. Rasmussen?
I agree with that. I think that essential workers and people who are likely to come into contact with the public, so not just home health aides, for example, healthcare workers, but also people at grocery stores and other essential businesses who might be coming into contact with a number of people in the population, should definitely be tested first. But really, we need to get to the point where we are testing people regardless of their risk factors, their occupation. I think that type of testing will absolutely be essential to sort of creeping out of this social distancing isolation situation that we're in now, because we need to be able to identify those pre-symptomatic individuals as well as identify clusters of infection that we might have missed by serology testing.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Dr. Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. She studies host responses to infection. We are talking about coronavirus. Dr. Paul Offit with us as well, director of the Vaccine Education Center, professor of pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine. He's also got a new book called Overkill: When Modern Medicines Go Too Far. And we want to hear from you, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Much more to talk about after this short break, including much more about vaccines. We'll be right back. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Drs. Paul Offit and Angela Rasmussen about coronavirus, this deadly pathogen, and the race to contain and stop its spread. Dr. Rasmussen, let me just go back to you. And I know in other countries, people's temperatures are being taken before they go into buildings. Do you see this as part of a smart effort to try to at least understand who might have this virus and how to contain its spread?
I think it's a start. Unfortunately, with this virus, because it presents in such varied ways, not every single COVID patient has a fever. And that has really hindered the efficacy of temperature testing as a sole screening method. So if there is a person who is pre-symptomatic, hasn't developed a fever yet, or is asymptomatic, does not develop a fever, temperature screening will not identify those patients, but they still may be able to transmit the infection.
Dr. Offit, here's a tweet. It says, I hear that many who need them are on ventilators, nonetheless die. If this is true, what could reverse it?
Right. I mean, this is the awful part of this virus. Yeah, I mean, even though you have as much supportive care as you can, and this is a virus, so it's not bacteria. We have antibiotics for viruses. Sometimes we have antivirals. We may or may not have one for this. We'll see. You're stuck with supportive care only, and despite the best of supportive care, not everybody lives, and that's been very frustrating.
Yeah, and just so sad and so tragic. Well, let's talk about vaccines. And Dr. Offit, you developed this, co-developed this rotavirus vaccine, as you mentioned. Took you a quarter of a century. We do not have that time. Dr. Fauci talks about 12 to 18 months. I know that people, labs are working hard to develop a vaccine, but help us understand what a vaccine would do for this, containing the spread of this virus.
Well, I mean, I think the only way to truly stop the spread of this virus would be a vaccine. I mean, that's the best way to develop herd immunity. No matter how much natural infection you have, still the best way to stop the spread of a virus is by vaccine. Witness measles. Well, we didn't really eliminate measles from this country until we had a vaccine. So I'll start with the good news. The good news is that certainly there's a lot of interest in making a vaccine. There are now more than 40 companies who are across the globe who are making it. There's plenty of money behind trying to make this vaccine. And the other good news is, you know, the protein you're interested in. Dr. Rasmussen said this early. It's the so-called spike or S protein. That's the protein on the virus that's associated with the virus binding to cells. If you can prevent the virus from binding cells by making these so-called neutralizing antibodies, then you can prevent infections. All good. The bad news is we still don't know how to make this vaccine. I mean, we're at the beginning stages of trying to make a vaccine. You know, do you want to take the virus and kill it the same way we make, say, the polio vaccine? Do you want to take the virus and weaken it the same way we make the measles vaccine? Do you want to take just that one protein? It's a so-called purified protein approach, which is the way we make the hepatitis B or human papillomavirus vaccine. Do we want to use a vectored vaccine where you basically take a different virus into which you insert then the genes that code for this protein the same way we make the dengue vaccine or the Ebola vaccine? You know, or do you want to use a completely different approach that has never been used for any commercially available vaccine, which is so-called genetic approach, which is, you know, being done right now by Moderna, the so-called messenger RNA vaccine, where already they are in clinical trials, or the DNA vaccine out of Novio, which is a Plymouth Meeting company that is already also starting clinical trials. We're just at the beginning. And that assumes you have to go through, not to be completely depressing, but you have to go through phase one and phase two trials to make sure, as you look at hundreds of people, that what you have is safe and it induces an immune response, even though at this point you still don't know what immune response you're looking for that tells you that this means that the person is protected. You don't really know that yet. And so you're going to have to do a large efficacy trial involving thousands, and depending on what the attack rate is at the time, tens of thousands of people. You really need to do that, because if you're going to be putting this vaccine into tens or hundreds of millions of people, you have to make sure before you do that you have tested this to make sure it is as safe as possible. You know, most of the people who are going to get this vaccine were not people who were going to die from this infection. So you have to make sure you hold it to a high standard of safety. And even then, you have to do the harder part, which is the scale-up part. You have to make sure you have the right buffering agent, the right stabilizing agent, the right vial. You have to do real-time stability studies. And then you have to have a process in place to make hundreds of millions of doses. That we could do that in a year and a half, to me, is remarkable. I just can't imagine how that's possible. I think 2 years would be remarkable if we could do that. So I don't see it. I mean, I hope that what doesn't happen is that in this rush, because we're terrified by this virus, because we're panicked by this virus, that we're willing to cut corners that shouldn't be cut before you put a vaccine into what Francis Collins described the other day as possibly a billion people.
How do you see it, Dr. Rasmussen?
I can't really agree with Dr. Offit emphatically enough. I think that it is absolutely critical that we do these safety and efficacy studies and do them on a large enough number of patients that we can determine that this vaccine, whichever vaccine ends up winning the vaccine race, that we can deliver that safely to billions of people potentially. I think that we can't make the immune system work any faster, and that is the only way to evaluate efficacy, is to give the vaccine to enough patients that we can look back at those patients and confirm that not only was the vaccine safe, but that the vaccine protected the majority of those patients from becoming infected. The only way we can really do that is by looking at them over a long period of time and counting the number of patients who receive the vaccine who actually become infected. People have been discussing speeding up this process by doing human challenge trials, which is the idea that you would vaccinate people and then you would actually challenge them with a dose of this virus. And personally, I don't feel that that is a very good way to go, because in many cases, we don't even know that these vaccine platforms will work in the majority of people, such as the mRNA vaccine that's furthest along in trials right now. Do we really want to give a potentially lethal virus to people when we don't know if the vaccine is actually going to protect them from it? I think it's a very ethically challenging question, and I really hope that if that does go forward, it's done with the utmost caution, because there are really substantial risks to speeding it up with that approach.
Absolutely. And Dr. Offit, it gets us thinking about these test subjects and an individual or a group of people's willingness to, I don't know, put their life on the line, risk their health in order to try to, in a sense, save the planet.
Well, again, I think probably the, at least from my understanding from discussions with people at NIH, is that the first group who would be tested, if we're to get to the point of a large scale efficacy trial, would be frontline responders, healthcare workers, because those are the ones who are most likely to be exposed and most likely to be exposed to larger quantities of virus. So that would be the easiest way to do that trial. But you're right. I mean, I think, again, what worries me here a little bit is I'd like to know for sure that this is going to go to the FDA. I mean, I'm on the FDA's vaccine advisory committee, so it would go typically before our committee. No vaccine would get licensed without being approved by that committee. And I fear that under the Emergency Use Authorization Act, that there may be a willingness to bypass the FDA. And I worry about mm-hmm. that. I mean, it's not the mRNA approach, which just, you know, BARDA, which is part of the Health and Human Services, just put $483 million behind that approach. They obviously love that approach. I mean, messenger RNA is very easily scaled up. That's good. And messenger RNA degrades very quickly in the body. So I don't think that's going to be a safety issue. But if you just take that vaccine alone, there's a complex lipid delivery system that has to be used for that vaccine that's never been, or that kind of vaccine that's never been scaled up, and for which we have virtually no clinical experience. And you can't, as much as we want this vaccine, you want to make sure that the vaccine induces a protective immune response and doesn't hurt you. Because even recently with a vaccine like the dengue vaccine, what we found was that the vaccine actually could hurt you, that the children who got that vaccine who'd never seen dengue virus before were actually more likely to develop something that has the fancy name of antibody-dependent enhancement, where they were actually worse off and more likely to die once they were then exposed to the natural virus than if they'd never gotten the vaccine. Those are the unpleasant surprises that come with vaccine development. So you want to make sure you hedge your bets as much as possible by testing as many people as possible before you give it to tens of millions of people, because you can rule out uncommon adverse events pre-licensure, but you can't rule out rare adverse events pre-licensure. I mean, that's only going to be known afterwards, but you can certainly, you know, increase your odds by doing as many people as you can before you give it to millions.
Here's an email from Julie. I'll put this to you, Dr. Rasmussen. And she says, will the antibody test offer any indication as to how long the person had developed the antibodies?
Unfortunately, no. So the antibody tests are fantastic to tell you if you have antibodies at the time that you are tested. So people who are currently infected, it may be in the stage before they develop those IgM antibodies, the early antibody responses, may be negative on the antibody test if they are tested at that time, but should later become positive for IgM and then for IgG antibodies. What those tests can't tell us is how long it's been if you do have IgG antibodies when you were infected and how long those antibodies are going to last. The only way to determine how long those antibodies are going to last is to follow people with those antibodies over time and see how long those antibodies remain in their blood. And unfortunately, there's really no way to hurry up that process.
And just a quick follow-up question. I'll put this back to you, Dr. Rasmussen, about contact tracing. Obviously, if someone test positive, then you want to figure out, well, who have they been in contact with? Is that, it seems like a rudimentary way of trying to sort of tracking this particular viral outbreak, but is that important?
That's absolutely critical. And contact tracing is a really classic epidemiological approach that has been used very successfully for the control of many different virus and pathogenic outbreaks. So the idea is that if we have widespread testing, you identify a person who is not known to have any exposure risk as being positive, then you can talk to all of their friends, all their family, all the people that they've been in contact with, identify those people and test them, and you can isolate the people who are infected and break the chain of transmission. So contact tracing will be key and essential for our attempts to control this virus going forward.
Dr. Efford, you mentioned herd immunity. Can we assume that people who have contracted this virus, including the guests that we had earlier, and maybe others who maybe didn't know they had the virus, but they did, or those who had mild symptoms, can we assume that they have some degree of herd immunity because of the numbers of people who probably have some kind of contact with this virus?
Well, I think you can assume that if someone contracted and recovered from this infection, that they're likely to be protected against reinfection, or at least moderate to severe disease associated with reinfection with this virus for at least a year and likely years, probably not decades, just based on sort of earlier studies with human coronaviruses to the degree to which that's applicable here. In terms of herd immunity, the only real way to develop herd immunity, population immunity, community immunity, is with a vaccine. I mean, there's probably no better example of that than measles. I mean, if you got a measles infection, I was a child of the 1950s, so I had a measles infection. That protected me for the rest of my life. Anybody who got a measles infection was protected for the rest of your life, unlike this virus, where I think it wouldn't be lifelong. Yet every year, there would be 2 to 3 million cases of measles and 48,000 hospitalizations and 500 deaths. The only way we eliminated measles from the United States was by vaccination, whereby we were able to eliminate it by the year 2000. So I think if people are looking to herd immunity as being the result solely of spreading infection, I think that offers some, obviously, herd immunity, but not what would be a critical amount to reassure us that we're going to be safe.
Dr. Rasmussen, here's an email from Barbara. Says, we hear that this coronavirus survives for various periods of time on different surfaces. What causes it to become non-viable and no longer able to infect a living host? Of course, that living host is us.
So we're still looking at the specific mechanisms by which the virus becomes non-infectious. We know that there are certain things that can be done to physically disrupt the virus, such as washing your hands with soap. We know that soap disrupts the envelope on the surface of the virus particle, and without that envelope, the virus is unable to infect cells. There have been two studies done with this virus in particular to look at how long it can persist on surfaces and in different environments. And it has been shown on some surfaces, such as plastic or stainless steel, or surgical masks to persist for days at a time. That said, and many people have been concerned by that. That said, over time, the virus does decrease in terms of how much infectious virus is there. So if you're putting virus on a plastic surface, for example, and you come back 72 hours later, there may still be infectious virus on that plastic surface, but it's going to be substantially reduced compared to the amount that initially was on there. What we don't know is what the minimum infectious dose of this virus is to infect a person. So it's possible that in that amount of time, the reductions in the virus that are on that surface are going to be sufficient to make sure that even if there's infectious virus there, it's not enough to actually cause an infection in you. But that is an area that we still need to do a lot of research in.
Dr. Efford, we're almost out of time here, but I mean, obviously we're dealing with this novel coronavirus, and not to be overly dramatic, but we know that, you know, humans are digging deeper into rainforests and having more interactions with wild animals. Is this just the beginning, do you think, of global pandemics?
Well, this has been with us forever. I mean, most of the infections that we have often were derived from animals, you know, human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, the cause of AIDS, was derived from simian immunodeficiency virus, in an event that probably happened in the 1930s in Cameroon. I mean, that tuberculosis is probably derived ultimately from an animal. Mycobacteria is similar to human tuberculosis. Rotavirus is also, you know, that. So, we have a close association with animals, and that was true here. The China has a taste for bats. They eat fried bats. They drink bat soup. They drink bat tea. This virus is roughly, the sequence is roughly 96% bat coronavirus. I think we can continue that this will continue to happen as it's always happened. So I think hopefully we'll be better at preparing for the pandemic as it comes. We certainly had enough warning here, I think, to prepare better than we had. And that's it. I think China at some level was not a good player here. We shouldn't have had to depend on a whistleblower to tell us that there was this virus spreading in Wuhan and then beyond. But I think hopefully we'll get better at pandemic preparedness. Certainly this is an unprecedented event in my lifetime.
Well, absolutely. And my appreciation to both of you, Dr. Paul Offit, Dr. Angela Rasmussen. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Aaronson, Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow. Wayne, thanks for joining us.